I'd like to call the subcommittee employee relations to order. We have a quorum, so that's helpful. Everybody's kind of scattered, so unfortunately, we'll be members will be in and out, and we're going to kind of go through presentations and then ask everybody to kind of come in for discussion and votes later on. But is anybody, Senator Metzen, you willing to move the minutes from our March 21st meeting? Any questions regards to the minutes? Thank you for looking at those, Senator Metzen.
I did read it. 7:30 this morning.
Pretty impressive. Good morning. All those in favor of the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The minutes are approved. Thank you, Senator Metzen. Others? So we have Mr. Dale. Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome. Thank you, everybody, for coming. I'm pretty impressed. It's a good thing we got in before the snow starts in May, of all times. Interesting. But Mr. Dale, go ahead with your presentation, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Christopher Dale. I'm the Senior System Director for Labor Relations for the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. I'm here to present the tentative agreement with the Minnesota State College faculty for your consideration this morning. Here's a brief overview of that agreement. If I may begin just by noting that the MSCF unit consists of about 6,000 or so faculty members, but that equates to about 5,000 FTE. So it's a fair-sized unit, and these are the two-year college instructional faculty, and they also serve in the library. They do some advising, so they have a number of other functions, but primarily they're instructional faculty. The biennial base for this particular unit was $788 million, so it's the third largest of the collective bargaining units in terms of money spent. In fiscal year 2012, there are no economic changes except that we have agreed to the insurance benefits as agreed to by MMB and the MAPE and AFSCME units. In 2013, faculty who were not at the top step of the salary schedule, which is divided into five columns, were not at the top step of their respective column, will receive a $3,500 base rate increase. In the MSCF unit, the salary schedule is set by the steps are separated by absolute dollar values, $1,750, and so unlike other units where there's a percentage relationship with the MSCF faculty, it's an absolute dollar value. Faculty who are at the tops of their salary schedule will not receive the $3,500, but instead...
Dale, could you just explain that $1,700 thing for me? I'm sorry.
Okay.
I don't understand it.
The steps are 17 absolute dollar value apart, so they're $1,700. Then, for example, step two will be $1,750 more in the base rate than step one. And that's so it proceeds up to the top of the salary schedule. There is a little aberration on the penultimate step, which is effectively a double step. But other than that, they're all $1,750. And this negotiated increase promises only $3,500 to everybody, not two steps for that penultimate step, but $3,500, except for those at the top. They get $2,400 on base, and they get a lump sum of $1,500. The other economic, a one-time lump sum, by the way, and that's in fiscal year 2013. And the other economic change was that the amount of what we call the sabbatical backlog fund was increased. This is basically a fund of money that is taken off the top of the contract in order to fund a program called sabbatical backlog. It's an attempt to catch up on the fact that we're behind with sabbaticals, and there's a formula that drives sabbaticals. This is just the extra effort to catch up, and MSCF likes to insist that money be allocated up front so that the institutions that end up having to support those sabbaticals, grant the sabbaticals to those faculty, can afford them. There are a few number of language changes, and I will just cover a couple of the most significant of the language changes and then stand for questions.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Metzen.
Mr. Dale, what's been the history on these raises the last three, 4, or 5 years? What have we been doing or not doing? Or
Mr. Dale.
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzen, the two-year college faculty, like our state university faculty, have not had a raise since fiscal year 09. So in fiscal year 10, 11, 12, and now, unless we agree to this agreement, there will have been no salary increases.
So that's 8 or 9? So that's
fiscal
nine.
Year 09 was the last increase.
Okay. I think I knew the answer, but I had to ask the question. So,
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Dale, does that include that assertion? Does that include step increases as well?
Mr. Dale.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, yes, it does.
Thank you.
So there was, Mr. Dale, there was no steps during that time?
Mr. Chair, there were no steps.
Well, please continue. Thank you.
Some of the more significant language increases include a new tutorial program that will allow teaching small enrollment classes that are traditional general ed or liberal arts type courses at a reduced rate. And this is we were pleased to get this particular change so that it'll allow us to present some of these classes where there are small enrollments at a reduced cost. Additionally, we secured an agreement to permit balancing of student contact hours. This contract actually regulates the number of contact hours in addition to the number of credits. It's fairly complex, but the ability to balance student contact hours across semesters and within a semester will help schools keep costs in line and where there are variabilities in a particular faculty member's schedule. In addition, another significant change from our perspective was some relief with respect to what we call the hiring practices requirements in our contract. The contract, like many of the classified agreements, seeks to regulate how much in the way of part-time and contingent faculty we can use, and it does that through this hiring practices language. We obtained some relief with respect to that, that currently we were not able to count unlimited part-time, that's essentially permanent faculty who are part-time, as part of the permanent cadre, and we are now able to do that, and we're able to not count these stipend payments and awards for excellent payments that have been renewed as part of the calculation, so that will assist us in meeting these required standards. At that point, I think I will stop and stand for questions that you may have and with respect to this contract.
Any questions for Mr. Dale? Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Mr. Dale, you mentioned the faculty who were at the top of their range. The summer here says they get an increase, a base increase of $2,400 and then a lump sum payment of $1,500. So they would actually receive a larger increase than those who were not at the top. Is that correct?
Mr. Dale.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, that is correct in fiscal year 13. But, of course, the lump sum is a one-time lump sum, and so it will not be paid again.
So, Mr. Chair.
Representative Drazkowski.
Could you review for us 12 and 13 for both groups, those that are at the top and those that are not?
Mr. Dale.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, during fiscal year 12, there are no base rate increases or no lump sums. And during fiscal year 13, there will be a $3,500 base rate increase for all faculty who are not at the top step. Those faculty who are at the top step will get a $2,400 base rate increase. We are not moving. It's a little bit of a, I don't know what I would call it, gerrymandered, but jerry-rigged setup in that we're not adding a new step. We're just simply moving those current faculty who are at the top. We're increasing their base rate to $2,400, and then they additionally get a one-time lump sum of $1,500.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you. So Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Dale, what you were saying, was it's fiscal 13 only. What you're saying is the lumps, if you take the lump sum off, the base of their salary is less, but still their increase for 13 is greater for those on the top. Is that kind of what you were saying?
Mr. Dale.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, I think that is what I'm saying.
Thank you.
Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a question on how it was determined what the chancellor and the vice chancellor salaries are. I mean, that's what I'm getting a hit with on the floor.
Mr. Dale, I believe that's in the other.
That's in the other one?
Yep.
Okay, sorry.
Nope. These would be good questions. Representative Pepin.
Thank you. Mr. Dale, I'm wondering if you could talk about the tutorials. How does that work? Do the professors have student contact? It looks like they have, so one-third of the credit hours they meet with the students, but they're getting paid at two-thirds the rate.
Yeah.
Could you just talk a little bit about the student contact, how much time commitment is there?
Mr. Dale.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, I can talk at a high level about this, but if we need to go into great detail, I'll have to call on my colleague. But essentially, the class is worth a certain amount of credits. So let's say it's a three-credit class. The contact hours will be reduced. It's a small class, though, so the idea is the contact will be more meaningful. The faculty member will be paid less, but the students will be earning the appropriate number of credits, and the idea is that with the smaller class size, they could be more self-directed. And if you want to get into greater detail than that, I would probably have to call on a colleague who actually helps administer the contract and has 4 years.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you. Well, maybe I'll just say what my understanding is, and if I'm wrong, you can correct me. So what it looks like is if it's a three-credit class, the professor would be teaching directly student contact for one of those hours but getting paid for two of three classroom hours. That's what it looks like, but you can correct me if I'm wrong on that.
Mr. Dale. I see a lot of nodding and...
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, I believe that is correct, but I want to call my colleague Tony Munoz, who's a system director for personnel and helps actually administer the contract and is more familiar with the detailed administration of the MSCF contract than I am.
Thank
Please
you,
introduce
good
yourself
morning.
For the record and go ahead.
Yes, thank you. Good morning. Yes, Tony Munoz, system director in our HR division at System Office for MSCF. To help clarify this unique delivery of tutorial, it is in fact the case that the faculty member teaching a tutorial would receive, in the case of an example of a three-credit class, the faculty member would receive two credits in terms of compensation. The unique delivery for the students, however, is 1 hour within the week of traditional classroom time, direct one-on-one student with or contact with the students, and the additional equated time for a traditional three-credit class would be self-directed assignments given to the students. It is our belief overall, however, that the instructor would have generally the same amount of contact with the students, but it would just be in a unique delivery format between directed classroom and self-directed assignments.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you. That's pretty much what I thought. Thank you. Could you talk a little bit, Mr. Dale? Probably I'm fine with that.
Thank you.
Could you talk a little bit about the sabbatical system and how that works? It's kind of confusing that it's number 10 on the list there. How a faculty member earns the sabbatical and what that might look like. It says anybody, at least 6 years of service, anybody who submits a plan may take a sabbatical. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Mr.
System?
Dale.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, again, I am familiar with the kind of the broad details of the sabbatical plan, but essentially the contract establishes a formula by how we determine what faculty will be eligible for sabbaticals, and we meet that formula and we do not exceed it. It's allocated by institutions, and then we have in addition what's called the sabbatical backlog, which is a kind of a secondary formula. That was agreed to in order to help reduce the substantial number of backlogs that exist with respect to faculty who actually qualify for sabbaticals but don't meet the formulaic standards to take a sabbatical. There's an institution per institution cap. And I can ask Ms. Munoz to come up again if you have additional questions.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Dale. Maybe perhaps that would be helpful, just because the way it's written, it looks like everybody, if you, as long as you submit a plan, you can get a sabbatical with at least 6 years of service. But I'm not clear how often are the sabbaticals allowed. Does everybody qualify? If you could just run me through that. I just thought that section was a little confusing.
Okay. Yes.
Ms. Funes.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Pepin. We grant approximately in the neighborhood of about 140 or so sabbaticals each year. The individuals, we do the eligibility process centrally in our system office by ensuring that the faculty member has a minimum of 6 full-time years served. That is the basic eligibility. I will say, however, individuals who apply for sabbatical often have many more years of service as they go forward to submit their plan. So as I said, we do the eligibility within our office. We also do the allocation of that number of overall sabbaticals that can be granted to our colleges throughout the system. We do that by looking at the type of faculty within this unit, those that came from the former MCCFA contract, those that came from the former UTC contract, and then there is a percentage that applies uniquely to each of those two types of faculty within the contract to determine the overall number at each of the campuses. The plans themselves are then managed at the local campus, and individuals apply through a standard set of forms and a process to our academic administrators, and they are charged with the responsibility to ensure that the plans that are submitted have a level of merit and rigor to them in order to be approved. And the type of plans or the criteria that our academic administrators would be looking for would be plans that are directed towards advancing the goals and mission of the particular college, certainly a level of renewal for the faculty member themselves, but moreover to ensure the advancement of the overall goals and institutional initiatives or system initiatives for Mincefear.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Ms. Munoz. It's early. I got left at 6:45 this morning.
I'm impressed you're here with the rain and traffic.
Hour 45. So I'm just curious, for how often can a person take a sabbatical if I were a professor and I qualified for a sabbatical? Is there a limit as to how many times I could get a sabbatical? And is there a limit between how many years I could apply again?
Ms. Bienes.
Yes, there is currently no limit on the total number of sabbaticals a faculty member could take within their career working for us. However, in order to qualify, a person has to have a minimum of 6 full-time years in between each sabbatical.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you. I think that's all I had for that. I did have one other question on I see on number 12, probably for Mr. Dale, on tuition. Mm-hmm. It said faculty can get up to 24 credits per year tuition waiver, or they can pass it on to their dependents for 16 credits per year. So my first question is dependents, can that be a spouse or kids or anybody? Is it just your kids? And then just the value, what's the average value of a credit? I'm trying to figure out what this package is worth.
Mr. Dale.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, yes, it is usable. The 24 credits are usable by the faculty member, and up to 16 may be used by the dependents. So that does include the wife and or spouse, depending on the gender of the faculty member at issue, and the dependent children. The value would depend to some degree upon what institution they went to. The faculty member, him or herself, is actually able to go to a community college or continue to a two-year college or go to a state university. So there would be some variation in the cost of the tuition credits between the two. The dependents are not. They're locked into the two-year system. And I don't know the exact current going rate for the credits at the two-year colleges, but I'm sure that Ms. Munoz might be able to help me out with that.
Ms. Munoz.
Mr. Chair, I don't have the exact figure in my head, I'm sorry, in terms of the current tuition level at our colleges. I believe it's in the neighborhood of around $150 a credit. If there's anyone in the audience that would care to correct me on that point, please do so.
Thank you.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Dale, what's the average salary and what's the average total compensation of the 5,000-plus faculty in this contract?
Mr. Chair, Representative Draskowski, the average salary in the two-year unit is about $60,900. I'm not sure what the average total compensation is. Faculty are able to pick up summer session, and they are able to pick up some additional work beyond the average base.
Representative Draskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Dale, is any idea what the benefit set is as a representation of the salary? Is it 30%? Is it 35, 40?
Mr. Chair, Representative Draskowski, I think we generally assume that it's about 28, but it probably is 30, I think, is a fair number to estimate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, thank you very much.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, Representative Draskowski. I'm sorry.
I do have some more. Sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry. I misunderstood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Dale, thank you. The number 8 on the sheet, is there currently a policy within MNSCU for RIFs, reduction in force, or is this a fragment from a reduction in force period in our history?
Mr. Dale.
Mr. Chair, Representative Draskowski, the language in the agreement is a residual from prior agreements, and it was essentially sunsetted during the 95-97 negotiations. That is, faculty who were eligible up to that time were grandfathered in, and those who came afterwards were not eligible for the early retirement incentive. So the system did address the fact that having a essentially permanent early retirement incentive was not necessarily the best way to effectuate early retirements when they were needed.
Representative Draskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Dale, I think you said after, help me, if you could say that again, after 1995, the policy blinked off, and are we blinking it back on now?
Mr. Dale.
Mr. Chair, Representative Draskowski, no, we are not blinking it back on now. It is perhaps worth noting that the legislature did authorize MNSCU to offer board incentives until 2014 by legislative action a couple of years ago, but we don't anticipate any of those currently.
Representative Draskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Dale, I'm reading under number 8 here. So if you're a college faculty member who was hired before June 30th of 1995, has 15 years of service, et cetera, and if you can demonstrate, or I don't know who demonstrates it here, that a layoff will be prevented, that a recall is allowed, if you can tell me what a recall is, that would be helpful, or result in a cost saving. So I would have a related question there. How often do your replacement faculty come in at rates that are greater than the retiring faculty? I would guess it's zero or something close to that, which appears to me to be an entitlement. But anyway, those would be my questions.
Mr. Dale, do you have the questions?
Mr. Chair, Representative Draskowski, I hope so. Let me see if I can try to address them. And if I can't, I might call on Ms. Munoz again. The short answer is a recall. Layoffs do happen. They tend to happen in this unit more than they do in the, for example, the four-year unit, but they are not as commonplace as they once were. The recall is actually would be somebody from the layoff list, and so that the retirement incentive, if it allowed a recall, then would be authorized. And the cost savings is, I think the fair answer is that most of the time our new faculty come in at a reduced, that is a lower rate of pay than the faculty who are retiring. I'd say that's essentially almost always true. There might be some rare exception in a market area where I think they have some sort of special ability to, in the really competitive market areas, to make a salary pay a higher salary than normally is dictated by. We have a very rigorous method of salary control, setting salaries in this.
So, Mr. Chair and Mr. Dale, so as I read that, or result in a cost savings, what that says to me, coupled with what I thought I heard you say, which is what I would expect, that that the younger or newer faculty would come in at a rate lower than the retiring faculty. It would seem that in almost every situation, or maybe every situation, where there's a retiring faculty member, that they're going to be able to demonstrate a cost savings. With that being the case, at least on paper here, it appears that that really everyone could qualify for up to 1 year's salary upon retirement if they began before 1995, had the 15 years of service, and were at least 55 years old. Is that in practice what we're seeing?
Mr. Dale.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, I don't believe that it is in practice what we're seeing, but the it is not always the case that a position is being replaced, so that there would be no cost savings in that case. That is not the way we measure cost savings if the position is not scheduled for replacement.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Dale, could you get us a number or a percentage of faculty who have retired over the last, 10 years who fit this description of hired before June 30th, 95, 15 years of service, and at least 55 years old. The percentage of people who fit that who have qualified for and been granted the 1 year salary upon retirement. That would be helpful.
Mr. Dale.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, we will endeavor to get that number for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Dale. Mr. Chair, just have one more question.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you. And that was on number 10, the sabbaticals that Representative Pepin was asking about. Do we know what percentage of eligible faculty take sabbaticals?
Ms. Munoz? Ms. Munoz.
I don't have the exact percentage, I'm sorry to say today, but it is relatively low. We again grant approximately 140 or so. We have an allocation of approximately 140 or so sabbaticals each year. We receive probably about 2% to 5%, depending upon the year, over that total number in terms of applicants. And, of course, we have the fixed allocation number. We can only grant that many. So we do have that small percentage that are over. In terms of those that would certainly qualify but choose not to apply, I'm sorry, I do not have that figure in my mind.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Munoz.
Thank you very much, you two. And please stick around. There might be questions as we further debate the bill or the motions or approval of the plans. Mr. Carlson, could you come forward and tell us about the plan for administrators?
Well, good morning,
good morning.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mark Carlson. I'm the newly appointed Vice Chancellor for Human Resources with the Minsky System, and I'm here to talk a little bit about the administrator's plan, which serves the smallest group within the system. There are approximately 550 administrators throughout the 54 campuses in the system. It represents about 2.9% of our total population. It includes such professionals as the chancellor, vice chancellors, presidents, vice presidents, deans, chief financial officers, chief academic officers, excuse me, chief human resource officers, and the like. The proposed changes that we're looking for here today would be the first increase since 09. There have been no increases, no steps, no increases since the 09 contracts. This would be the first increases in 4 years. For fiscal year 12, we're looking for no increase to base, but a $1,250 lump sum for those administrators that serve during that fiscal year. For fiscal year 13, we're proposing the elimination of the lump sum incentive pay for chancellor, vice chancellors, and presidents, often referred to as the bonus money, and that would go away. We're looking for a 3.8% merit pool, which would be pay at risk. No increases in salary ranges for the chancellor, vice chancellors, or the presidents. And an increase in the range on the salary schedule for administrators other than the chancellor, vice chancellor, and presidents by 2%. This does not increase anybody's salary, but it moves the schedule for the future 2% forward. Some language changes. We're clarifying the additional remuneration provision to exclude, again, the bonus pay. We're clarifying some advanced language on the reinstatement of sick leave, which was a kind of a complicated formula that we're just cleaning up some language there. We're updating some language to address the delegated authority of presidents, permitting some limited increase for certain cross-institutional lateral transfers. Those administrators that move as an opportunity for stretch assignments to move from one campus to another, as an opportunity to increase their skill set and to make them competitive for future leadership positions. We see this as an important piece of succession planning. And then allow some market adjustments as approved by the chancellor. With that brief introduction of the administrative plan, I will stand for questions. Chair Lowy.
Thank you very much, Mr. Carlson. It's been I'm sure you've been following discussion, in particular in the House, as regard to some of this was on the floor, and I'm sure Chair Pawlowski and Representative Draskowski and others will be looking at the Minsky system and in the next year in summertime. I think they've committed to some meetings. Any questions for Mr. Carlson? Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Well, let's just start at number one, the chancellor salary. And I think it's also listed in 6A. It says the current salary is 360, and you mentioned that the range will not change, but my understanding is that the range is up to 390,000. So on paper anyway, the chancellor's salary could increase. It says the board has the authority to set the salary. So presumably the board could come and say, well, this chancellor should be at the maximum of the range, 390. And how often does that how does that process work? How often does the board meet to discuss the salary? When does it happen? How does it fit into the rest of this?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, the chancellor is reviewed annually by the board through an annual performance management process where the goals set by the board for the chancellor are reviewed, and the board makes a determination whether or not that the chancellor has achieved those goals and would make any adjustments to a salary accordingly.
Representative Pepin.
Thanks. And you're not the boards, and you don't set the salary, but, you know, 360 is the minimum it says for 2007 was 270. So 360 is really at the far end of the range. And just wondering if you could talk a little bit about why it's so far to the edge of the range. Do you have an idea on that?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, I don't have the history. I can certainly speak to the difficulty of finding qualified people to lead an incredibly complex system that is Minsky. In the few months that I've been on board, I can attest to the complexity of managing 18,500 employees scattered across 54 campuses. It's incredibly complicated organization, and we are very fortunate to have a leader who can manage such a diverse and complex organization. I think it was a very from what I understand, it was very arduous process. It was very rigorous process to search out and hire the current chancellor. And I know, looking at market data across the nation, that this is right at the median for somebody in a system similar to ours.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you. And I'm just moving down to vice chancellors, looking at this document, personnel plan for administrators. And I think it says on here somewhere, too, the minimum range for vice chancellor is 129, 375, and the maximum is 318 under the 2012-2013 changes. And wondering if you could talk a little bit about, you might have mentioned how many total administrators, how many vice chancellors are they, and what is the average pay for a vice chancellor?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, there are five vice chancellors. And while I don't have the actual number, I would indicate, I would venture an educated guess that that number would be somewhere in the 165 annual rate.
Representative Pepin.
Are any of them at the top of the range?
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Carlson.
No.
Okay, and then.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you. Mr. Carlson, just going on to the presidents, if you could talk about the same type of thing, how many presidents are there? I'm trying to, this document's a little bit confusing. I'm on page 34 of the document. I don't know if everybody's got a copy of that or not, but the salary range, it looks like the minimum for 2013, I guess in 2025, is $51,274. That's for the very minimum pay for a range one. And then the maximum is $242,754 for a range of 16 maximum. Could you talk a little bit about where most people fall, the average of where people fall in the range?
Mr. Carlson.
How many are in the maximum, too?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, you're looking at actually a scale that is that applies to all but presidents, vice chancellors, and the chancellor. So the range max for a president is 328, and the minimum is 116 on page 33. And that we have 31 institution presidents, and they're basically in three categories. You've got the combination tech school and community college. You have the tech schools and the community colleges, excuse me, and we have the universities. So the using market data, the chancellor in consultation with the Board of Trustees looks at the market and places the initial contract for those presidents at a level that the board and the chancellor feel is appropriate. Good stewards we have a fiscal responsibility in place. We're trying to get the best bargain we can, but we also want the best talent we can afford.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Do you know what the average is? The average and what? How many are at the top of the range?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, it varies very widely. There are no presidents at the top and no presidents at the bottom. I would say for the 2 years, the average would be somewhere, and again, I'm making just an educated guess, having looked at a lot of data in the 160 range, maybe 180 range for the two-year institutions. And then maybe something around 210 or so, 220 for the four-year institutions.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you very much. And then the other, I was in the wrong range before, but if you could just do the same for the other administrators that are not presidents or vice chancellors, I think that was the range that I read before.
Right.
I imagine if there's 550 administrators total, that would, so there'd be over 500 additional administrators, and if you could then talk about the averages and where people are at on that as well, that would be helpful.
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, you're right. There are 513 or so administrators that are not presidents of vice chancellors or the chancellor. And those duties range wildly. And so, again, it would be difficult to put an average salary on 513 quite disparate functions. But I suspect it would be, again, making an educated guess, in that 70,000, 80,000, 90,000 range, something like that, is an average of the entire population.
Representative Pepin.
I can look a little bit more and let somebody else ask some questions. Thank you.
Chair.
Senator Metzen.
Yeah, Mr. Carlson, you mentioned, I think, two times, 550 employees or something, and on the salary settlement sheet, that indicates 633. Are you not replacing people, or are you cutting back, or is the 633 the right number? Because that's a difference of about 80 employees. So,
Mr. Carlson.
Right. Mr. Chair, Senator Metzen, the 633, there are people coming and going all the time. I took a snapshot in time when I put my materials together, and we had 550 on the rolls at that point in time. But there are people coming and going all the time, so that number could vary significantly.
Senator,
but we are
550 indicates some savings there, too, for a while anyway.
Absolutely. We are definitely, we do not
necessarily have to replace people all the time. Probably. But they come and go, and you're at 550 now, Mr. Chairman. So that indicates that salaries are some savings in there.
You're absolutely right. We look very carefully when to replace an administrator. We certainly have heard you. We understand the issues surrounding administrators. It's a complex system. We need highly qualified people to manage the system, but we are very careful. And one of my charges is to make sure that if we can hire somebody at non-administrative level, then we're going to do that.
Senator Metzen.
No, just that, Chairman, that's good news to hear that you know.
Thank you, sir.
Representative Draskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Carlson, the career development and tuition waiver, page 30 of the plan document, number 11 on the summary, 24 semester credit hours. Now, I haven't gone to college for a while, and they had quarters where I went, but I think 12 credit hours per semester is a lot. That's not for you, Deb.
Is that a comment or a question? We have you have two star students surrounding you there.
So I know, I'm struggling.
Someone's about ready to get their degree here.
So that's up to 12 credits per semester, which it seems significant. I don't know what percent of time that would encumber to somebody's daylight hours that they might be operating and not sleeping. But I wonder how much residual there is for them to actually do their job, given those very generous benefits. And how does that happen? How is it monitored? Do we know that they're actually working?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Draskowski, the 24 semester credit hours are for the family per year. And they are monitored in terms of we know who's using them. They have to be approved by the supervisor to use that. It is less than it's less of a benefit than our faculty contracts allow.
Representative Hillstrom,
Thank you. This is to Representative Draskowski. Representative Draskowski, 12 credits in law school is considered part-time. I believe both myself and Representative Pepin have done up to 12 credits while serving in the legislature, and I additionally clerked at a law firm as well. So I think that people probably can teach and take that many credits.
Representative Drazkowski.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative Hellstrom. But Mr. Carlson, what number of credits is considered full-time at these institutions?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to ask my colleague, Mr. Dale, to answer that question.
Mr. Dale.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, it depends on which which type of institution you're going to. At the state universities, 12 credits would be considered a full-time, reasonably a full-time load. But if you were going to one of the two-year colleges, it would not.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Dale. So as I read, again, the plan, 1.12 career development tuition waiver, the administrator has the ability to use up to 24 hours of semester credits themselves, and if they don't use them, then somebody in their family can use them. This is just amazing to me. Basically, if you're an administrator, it appears that your family goes to school free. That's a huge benefit. I've never seen that before. The other question I have, Mr. Chair and Mr. Carlson, my favorite wasteful spending that happens at the Minsky system is the seven presidents that are given stipends of $24,000 in order to hold faculty senate meetings at their house. Do we still have that, and where would I find that in the plan?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chair.
Is that true?
Representative Drazkowski, I'm going to ask Mr. Dale to help me with that particular one, but I think we have a little bit of a misunderstanding there.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, we do currently provide a housing allowance with respect to the seven state university presidents. It's based on our information that is common for master's types institutions to receive, four-year institutions for presidents of those institutions to have this type of allowance. We do provide it, and it is located in 1.03 subdivision 1G, sorry, subdivision 3G, I believe, or 2G. It's part of the additional remuneration, and we have now tried to clarify that the additional remuneration language can be used for that amount or other amounts that are typically given to a president or an equivalent administrator, because the additional remuneration covers the president, the chancellor, and the vice chancellors, those on contracts. So that's where it's referenced.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Dale, can you review again how that works? I mean, my memory is telling me that that the faculty were saying, you know, we don't have the right types of facilities at our institution to hold these fancy fundraising meetings, and because of that, we have to hold these meetings at our own personal house, and then there's a stipend that goes with it, and that's the $24,000 I recall. Is that still so? Could you review for us how that works, and is the $24,000 still the amount?
Mr. Dale or Mr. Carlson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, the $24,000 is the amount. It's been the amount for quite some time. The idea behind it, I think, has always been there have been a multiple set of reasons why it was that state university presidents received a housing allowance, and that is that their colleagues in other institutions, similar institutions across the country, received that housing allowance for a variety of reasons. But it does include the idea that you would conduct, you know, university events at your home. In addition, I think there are probably other reasons why that has become the practice at four-year institutions, as opposed to two-year institutions where we don't provide that benefit.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Dale, that's one I'm going to continue to bird dog, Mr. Dale, and I hope we can bring some sensibility back to that part of the contract, because
that doesn't really jive with what my constituents are thinking about.
Representative Hillstrom, I know you raised your hand earlier, but had you... Representative Pepin.
Thank you. I just have a few more questions here under the other provisions. You talked about it a little bit under number three, the additional remuneration for housing allowance, and I just wasn't sure. What would the average package look like, the dollar amount that would be allowed for all those things together, and then who would qualify? Is it for any administrators or just for the university, the seven presidents of the university or the additional presidents? Who exactly qualifies for that, and what's the average or there's a max allowance? If you could clarify that.
Mr. Dale.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, there is a max. The additional remuneration cannot exceed 30% of the base pay for any particular president. The standard has been to allow for the state university presidents a housing allowance and essentially what amounts to a travel and communication allowance. And the housing allowance has been the $24,000 that Representative Drazkowski mentioned earlier for many years, and it has not changed. That is not available to the two-year college presidents. They don't receive that particular allowance. And they may receive a travel and communication allowance. Typically, that there is some variation in that, and they, as I understand it, they run from around, I think, about $4,500 to $7,000 for the travel and communication allowance. What we're trying to specify, what we're trying to clarify through our changes in the administrative plan language is that only those types of allowances or only that type of additional remuneration that is common to this position in other institutions would be allowed. And so we were trying to specifically provide that that this additional remuneration could not be used to fund what has become, I think, somewhat derisively referred to as the bonus pay. So that's part of the reason, the motivation for trying to clarify what the additional remuneration could be used for.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Dale. Mr. Carlson, I'm not sure, Mr. Dale, if you specified who, did you just say the 7 4-year presidents qualify for this, but not other administrators, not the 2-year, just the 7?
Mr. Dale.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, what I said was the 7 state university presidents are those are the individuals that are, and the chancellor are the individuals that are granted the housing allowance. The other 2-year college presidents, currently I believe 24 2-year college presidents, are not granted a housing allowance.
Thank you. And then
Representative Pepin.
Mr. Chair, and then moving on to number 4. Just curious in that. It says you're eliminating a provision that limits the maximum term of initial contract with the chancellor to 3 years. And you're leaving intact a provision that limits the term of a contract with the chancellor to 5 years. So you're making the contract longer, and I know this probably doesn't happen as much in when it's not attached to the athletic department, but my concern there is why would we increase that amount? Why would we increase the if it's a non- a chancellor that isn't performing well, why would we want to increase it to 5 years?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, the purpose of this is based on the board chair wanting to have the opportunity to, I believe it was such an arduous and difficult and time-consuming process for the board to go through the selection process to find a qualified chancellor that we'd like to be able to offer on initial contract a five-year opportunity to serve. Having said that, if they're an at-will employee, they can be released at any time by the board. So if they're not performing, their contract specifically says, the chancellor's contract specifically states that they could be let go at any time.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Carlson. And if that were to happen, so if the chancellor decides something happens, some scandal, and the chancellor has to be let go in 2 years, what is the package that the chancellor would get?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, I do not have the contract in front of me, but it would be a basic severance would be a formula of 40% of the chancellor's sick leave, whatever vacation balance he might have, but I'm not familiar with any other provisions in the currently he, right?
You heard me.
But I, I'm not familiar with any other provisions within that contract that would result in payments to the chancellor should be terminated.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you. So it sounds like the chancellor doesn't get a specific monetary buyout package based on his salary. Is that what you're saying, Carlson?
Mr. Carlson.
Other than the 40%.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, if an individual, any administrator, is terminated for cause, there would be absolutely no payout outside of what is obligated through the sick leave formula and whatever vacation they would have on the books. There would be absolutely no payment.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you. That's good. No Tubby Smith situation here. I like that. Number 12, though, could you explain that? So that's not the chancellor. That looks like it's for any administrator. They get 5% of the administrator's final annual base salary if they give at least 9 months' notice of resignation of retirement. Why, I guess, is the question I have.
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, this is, interestingly enough, this is quite typical within higher education because of the academic cycle and the difficulty in hiring deans and vice presidents and whether it be an athletic director or what have you. The more time we have to find this sort of person who's probably under contract in another institution, the better. So this gives us that opportunity. It incents administrator to give us the time necessary to replace him or her with the appropriate fill. And so it's really a cost savings for us because if somebody were to leave abruptly, it's great turmoil within the institution. It causes all sorts of we might not have the opportunity to hire that right person behind. So this is again, fairly typical within higher ed, and it coincides with the cycle of academia.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have like maybe three so questions more. You've mentioned that several times. It's typical because it's difficult to get these people in these positions. It's difficult to get a chancellor. It's difficult to get administrators. It's difficult to get presidents. And I'm wondering why it's so difficult. They're extremely high-paying jobs. And is it the educational background? Why is it that it's so difficult to fill these positions? Because with this economy and these salary ranges that I feel are quite generous, why is it so difficult? Maybe you could talk a little bit about what's the educational requirement to become a vice chancellor or a president that makes it so difficult to get them hired.
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, that's an excellent question. And being having spent 35 years in the human resources business, I have never found an environment so difficult to hire qualified people. And I think this has several factors in play. One is just a demographic issue. We have the baby boomers moving through. We last year conducted, I believe, 5 presidential searches. We are estimating as many or more next year just because people are retiring. And that happens to be the case throughout the nation. So there is a lack of qualified candidates for these high-level administrator positions. Oftentimes they require a doctorate. Certainly for any president, it would be not just a PhD or ED, but several years, 10, 15, 20 years or more of progressive experience within a higher education environment. I'll be blunt too and say that finding somebody to move from San Diego to International Falls is a bit of a challenge. And so we have some market issues there as well. But we pay on our 2 years. The data would indicate, and I've done a lot of research on this, we pay our 2-year institutions, frankly, at about the 20th, 29th percentile of what other institutions are paying their two-year institution presidents, making it very difficult for us to recruit. And again, there's just a demographic issue at play here, too, in that there are just so many institutions looking for qualified leaders that it's a highly competitive market.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you. Well, you know, the salaries are good, so I'm kind of shocked that there aren't more people. Sounds like you need to have a lot of education. That's good, but it seems sort of excessive to me. I just have one more question, or maybe it's more of a comment, and that's on, again, to the tuition reimbursement that Representative Drazkowski talked about, and it says tuition up to 24 semester credit hours, and I think that one of the two of you had mentioned that would also go to family members. You didn't specify if it was a spouse or not, but I think you did before, so it'd be spouse or kids. And, you know, I mean, the thing about that is that occurs to me is that we all get constituents that come in that are students that are struggling to pay their way. The tuition's high, they feel, and you can argue whether or not you think it's high or not, but there are a lot of families throughout the state that are really struggling to send their kids to school. And I know that we all get constituents in that say, you know, can you get them to stop raising our tuition? And it's frustrating when the administration gets paid very well and the tuition continues to go up. And I understand there are a lot of costs and there are a lot of things that go into that, and I'm not trying to simplify it. But when the administrators have 24 semester hours for their own kids, and I went over some of the averages before, and the low end of the average that you said on the other administrators, that's not even including presidents, vice chancellors, the chancellor, the kind of average you gave me was $70,000. So the administrators get to give their kids 24-hour semester credit hours for free. And I can see, you know, if you're a more of a, you know, rank and file staff person or, you know, even a professor there, I can see that benefit. But when the salaries are so high and there's so many families that are struggling to send their kids to school, do you really think that's a fair benefit to give a bunch of high-paid administrators, frankly?
I don't know that you...
You don't have to answer that.
Well, that's just a comment. I don't think it's fair. You pass that on.
Representative Pepin, I think there's probably quite a bit of agreement amongst... Certainly in my case there is, and I don't totally disagree. I'm looking forward to some of the discussion this summer with... Representative Drazkowski and Chair Pulowski to see where that leads the state of Minnesota. But Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to comment that I know in particular in the nursing field that one of the biggest problems we have is finding instructors who are willing, nurses who are willing to be instructors, because they make so much less than their students do the day they graduate. I mean, $70,000 is not unusual for a graduating nurse. And if you're getting lesser at that rate to be an instructor, there's not a whole lot of incentive to teach. And I suspect that's true in a lot of fields. We got Fortune 500 companies paying millions to their CEOs and administrators, and I'm guessing that a lot of these people would qualify for those positions.
Senator Metzen?
It's all, Mr. Chairman, it's all competition. And people are competing nationwide and internationally for the same people, and it's all part of one big package, whether it's the money for housing. I think I would guess 100% of the campuses across the country are doing that. I would guess that these salaries, I don't have the comparisons nationwide, but I'd like to see them. I don't think we're out of line here. And you have to pay people. I've been saying that all my years in this business, is that to get qualified people, whether it be teachers or all the way up the ladder, you have to pay people. And you've been stagnant. Your groups you're talking about this morning and some of the other ones we talked about earlier, since 2009. I think it's 2008, but everybody keeps saying 2009. But that's 5-6 years without a bump, and that's not right. That's just not right. We have to pay our people, and I'm a strong supporter of. Somebody said at will. Well, get rid of people if you want. I mean, they're at will employees, so you could send them out the back door or the front door. Well, anyway, I just my philosophy is again, we have to pay people and qualify people.
Mr. Chair,
thank you very much. Representative Drazkowski.
One quick question, I could thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Carlson, Mr. Dale, can you tell us just briefly about the review price process? How often are the criteria reviewed for the hiring of these administrators? You talked about the qualifications. It sounds like there's pretty high bars set there, both in terms of educational requirements, tenure in a similar field, et cetera. I think some people in the private sector would suggest that maybe some of those need at from time to time to have some revisiting, especially as you think about maybe private sector people starting to move into some of these areas. How often are those revisited, and how are those determined?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, I think I understand your question, and certainly every time a vacancy occurs, is the opportunity for those of us in the human resources profession to take a good look at the job and make sure it's still relevant. Does it need to be in the administrator's plan? Could it be in a different plan? What's the competitive salary? What are the minimum qualifications? What are the preferred qualifications for that particular position? And we do on occasion, in fact, one of our vice chancellors was recently hired from the private sector, and we do open the door. We're not a closed society in that if you're not in higher ed now, you're not going to get in higher ed. I'm an example of that as well, coming from public service but outside of higher ed. So I think that the qualifications are carefully reviewed on every vacancy. And again, my charter is to take a look at whether or not we need an administrator and to acknowledge the fact that we're going to limit the number of administrators in our system and continue to work on that. So I hope I answered your question, Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. I'd like to move on to Mr. Lee to hear about the new MNCHR.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Metzler.
These are extremely important things we're doing this morning, but I know there's 2, 3, 4 other committee meetings that I should be at, and
yep.
Sometimes we ask the same question over and over in different ways, and maybe we can, again, this is very important stuff, but I think we have to move on, and I know I've got 2 committee meetings going myself at this time, and I had Senator Saxog and Senator Eaton do it, I'm sure. So that's not to say we don't submit the stuff. But anyway, comment.
Be brief.
Mr. Chair.
Please.
My name is Jim Lee. I'm from Minnesota Management and Budget. I'm here to present the inaugural compensation plan for MNCHR. This is a unique experience for me, and I think Mr. Hubinger. We don't recall ever having a plan come before the committee that doesn't have any employees in it yet. The MNCHR agency will eventually have about 85 employees total. The compensation plan is authorized to cover their managerial employees, all of whom will be unclassified at-will employees. And what we have done for this inaugural compensation plan is borrow by reference large portions of the managerial plan that this subcommittee has already approved. And we have taken some of the pay ranges from the managerial plan and put them into this compensation plan for future use. We don't have positions assigned to specific salary ranges at this point. We are engaging a consultant to work with us to give us some good information, both externally and some help dealing with internal equity issues within the executive branch. For the record, all of the people working in the MNCHR unit right now are actually employees of management and budget, and at some point between now and July 1st, we want to move them into this compensation plan.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Mr. Lee?
Yes.
Senator Benson.
Thank you. Mr. Lee, so there will be approximately 15 people covered under the plan we're discussing today. Is that correct? Because there's a reference to 85 employees. Just want to understand how big the pool is today.
Mr. Lee.
Mr. Chair, correct. There are currently 11 managers covered or will be in positions covered by this plan, and we expect that to grow by two or three.
Senator Benson.
Thank you. I see a reference, a maximum range of $156,000. Is that, can you please tell me how that fits within the statutory salary guidelines that you can't exceed the governor's salary?
Mr. Lee.
Mr. Chair, there is actually no statute that says that no employee can make more than the governor. There are a variety of statutes when taken together result in a large number of employees not making more than the governor, but there are also hundreds of exceptions to it. Right now, state agency head salaries for the major agencies are capped at $114,000. Most of them actually have salaries of $108,000.
And Senator Betson.
Mr. Lee, why is the manager of Minsure worth more than an agency head?
Mr. Lee.
Mr. Chair, there are other agency heads in state government making more than the governor and making more than the governor's appointees.
Senator Benson.
I'm sorry. Mr. Lee, you just mentioned that there was a cap for agency heads. What was that number?
The cap for the, Mr. Chair, the cap for the governor's appointees in the major agencies is statutorily $114,000. But there are agency heads who are have their salaries set in the managerial plan or in other statutes that do make more than that.
Okay. Senator Benson.
And, Mr. Lee, given that this is all new and completely untested, and given that there was such controversy as this bill went through committee over pay for these managers, why did you take the highest number in state government instead of bringing it down and setting it more in line with a major agency head?
Mr. Lee.
Mr. Chair, the fact that we published that range doesn't mean we're actually going to use it. We're just giving ourselves the flexibility if we need to. And when the consultant reports back to us, which should be around the 1st of June, we'll then have a better idea where these positions need to be paid. We do have a very little bit of information from other states that are setting up exchanges where they are paying around $200,000 for executive directors. Some of them are paying less.
Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lee, isn't there already somebody in the executive director role?
Yes, there is.
And
Senator Benson,
Mr. Chair, that's all right. Mr. Lee, do you intend to give her a raise?
Mr. Lee.
Mr. Chair, that would be up to Commissioner Showalter, who is acting in lieu of the board until late summer, early fall, as to what he does, and he would base that decision on whatever the consultant gives us. I can tell you that internal equity with other state agencies is a big factor in his decision-making process.
Senator Benson.
And thank you. Mr. Lee, I have really significant concerns that there's a level of tone deafness at MMB over how controversial these high-end salaries are going to be for what is a brand new, largely out of legislative reach, independently operating organization that has now earned a reputation for spending, shall we say, quite generously. For example, the money spent on branding Minsure, the $110 million spent by the feds, and now they're coming back asking for more in the human services budget. They have approximately $60 million in withholds from the plans that participate in the exchange. I cannot tell you enough how much this will be under scrutiny. And I think a level of judgment needs to be applied that says this is a very politicized environment, a brand new quasi-government entity, largely independent, but under the purview of the government. And I would suggest an abundance of caution as you go forward with these incentives. They seem quite generous for what is largely untested. We're talking about merit increases. We're talking about performance incentives not to exceed 10% of base salary. I know these are going to be tough jobs. I know this is an extremely difficult project that they are undertaking. But with all due respect, the executive director knew that's what it was when she signed on and as this was being designed, and she has been all along saying that this isn't going to be a problem. So I am not sure how the commissioner can justify a raise when we were told all along this isn't going to be a problem, it's all going to be well managed. So it's a very politically sensitive issue, and I would suggest not using the top end of that range and being very cautious about merit in what is going to be under the microscope public scrutiny.
Thank you, Senator Benson. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lee, the draft of this outlines or references a managerial plan in multiple places. In addition to the concern around the range, salary ranges, which I heard you say are only going to be published, and once they're published, it seems to me to provide the authority to follow those. But the question is, realizing that the managerial plan is referenced here, if there are employees that are hired in July or August or whenever they might be hired, are they also eligible for the COLA and step increases in the managerial plan in addition to the salaries?
Mr. Lee, and we're going to have to we'll have to move along here at some point, but no, please answer the question.
Okay.
And then
Very quickly, Mr. Chair, no, they would not be. There is a date at which they are going to move from the managerial plan into this plan, and we're struggling to get that done by July 1st, so they no longer be managerial plan employees. And I tried to be careful to exclude any of the other wage adjustment language that's in the managerial plan from being dragged into this one.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Lee and Mr. Chair. Mr. Lee, the governor just appointed seven members of the MNSURE board? Is that right? When are they effective? When do they become effective?
Mr. Chair, I don't know
Mr.
the answer
Lee.
To that question.
Does anyone know?
I think it's May 1.
It's in the bill. I don't know.
Mr. Huebinger's suggesting it's May 1st.
Today.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, the six public members were named, the Commissioner of Human Services is seven. And my understanding is that under the law, Commissioner Showalter has the authority to act as the board until, sometime in September. There is a trigger mechanism where they need to get some policies and procedures in effect before they can be activated, if you will.
Representative Pepin.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Drazkowski.
Mr. Lee, can you repeat that again? So they're appointed, but they're not?
They're appointed, but they don't. The commissioner has their authority to act, and this plan is one example of that. He is, while the board has the authority to have a compensation plan, acting as the board, he is proposing a compensation plan. And he will act in their stead until, I believe, it's September.
So Mr. Chair and Mr.
Representative Drazkowski.
Mr. Lee, I guess my pointy question to that is, in the health insurance exchange language, we said somebody cannot have been employed within 1 year prior to at any time during their appointed term,
to a variety of areas related to the health field, and Representative Pepin and I struggled with this provision in the Government Operations Committee in the House. And we have at least one of the appointees who worked in the healthcare field up through June of last year. So apparently, the governor may have appointed somebody in conflict with the law. What do we know about that?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Lee. I know nothing about that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Pepin,
I was just going to comment. I see that you're.
Thank you for helping us.
Everyone's tired. I just have a comment then, if you wouldn't mind. I was looking at the range, and this is sort of on what Senator Benson said. You know, I was just looking at the plan includes 24 ranges, and I just did some quick calculations. If you're just talking about the 12 employees at the very level one maximum, that's $832,000 a year. If you did 15, that's over $1 million per year, and that's just at the very, very lowest level maximum, the level one maximum. If you go into something like 100,000 a year, that's 1.2 million and 1.5 million. If you go from 12 to 15 employees per year, and that's just the managerial part. And anyway, so I guess my point is, along with the additional 85 employees, I don't think the public understands how incredibly outrageous this miniature proposal is, the excessive cost. So I would just urge that you go, because of that you very much lean toward the minimum side of the ranges on all of your managerial and staff positions.
Mr. Chair.
Yep. And Senator Benson.
If I could, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Lee, how will we learn of these salaries when they're announced, when the commissioner makes his decision?
Mr. Lee.
Mr. Chair, there's no formal process for us to notify you, but we could notify Mr. Hubinger when the appointments are made at his request. You could just keep in touch with me and ask for an update on where we are.
Senator Saxhawk.
Mr. Chair, I'd move the resolution recommending approval of the collective bargaining agreement.
The SER1 has been moved by Senator Saxhawk. Representative Benson, or Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just asked for a roll call.
Roll call has been requested, and... roll call has been requested, and Mr. Hubinger will call the roll.
Representative Lilly?
Aye.
Representative Drazkowski?
No.
Representative Hillstrom?
Aye.
Representative Pepin?
Nope.
Representative Winkler absent. Senator Benson?
No.
Senator Chamberlain is absent. Senator Eaton?
Aye.
Senator Metzen?
Aye.
Senator Saxhawk?
Yes.
SER1 passes 5-3.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
I would move the SER2.
Any questions to the SER2? Representative Drazkowski.
Roll call request, Mr. Chair.
Roll call has been asked for and requested. Mr. Hubinger will call a roll.
Representative Lilly?
Aye.
Representative Drazkowski?
No.
Representative Hillstrom?
Aye.
Representative Pepin?
No.
Representative Winkler is absent. Senator Benson?
No.
Senator Chamberlain is absent. Senator Eaton?
Aye.
Senator Metzen?
Aye.
Senator Saxhawk?
Yes.
SER2 passes 5-3. Just want to thank everybody for a respectful discussion. I know we could have asked questions. We'll have other opportunities and other stops to ask questions. And Representative Drazkowski.
Just quickly, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to commend Mr. Hubinger on the table that he put together. I'm one of those who has been urging this type of information. I think this is great data for us as we move forward in this committee. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Great job.
Thank you, everyone. With that, we are adjourned.
Oh, that was a mistake.